Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the May 29th, 2026 issue of the Week. Hello, and as a reminder, we are in our second reading from the May 29th issue, and this show will actually run for 2 weeks before we have a new issue in mid-June. We did the cover drawing, main stories, and a lot of the current news last week. This week, we will start on the briefing. Destination unknown. Some migrants can't legally be sent home, so President Trump is deporting them to third countries. What is a third country deportation? It's the removal of a migrant or asylum seeker to a country with which he or she has no legal or personal ties. While only about 17,500 of the more than 800,000 people deported so far during President Trump's second term have been sent to third countries, those removals are a key part of his immigration agenda. His administration has brokered transfer deals with at least 33 nations, most of them poor and corruptly run, and has paid at least $44 million to those countries in connection with the deportation agreements. The Department of Homeland Security argues the policy is needed to remove migrants who are so uniquely barbaric that their own countries won't take them back. But most third country deportees have no criminal record, and most have been granted some form of legal relief that bars the government from shipping them home, where they may face torture, persecution, or death. Some migrants have been removed suddenly from detention centers and flown to countries in Africa, Latin America, or Central Asia with abysmal human rights records. They took us, they put us on a plane, and they chained us by our hands and feet, said one Colombian deportee, who didn't know until mid-flight that his destination was the Democratic Republic of Congo, an active war zone. The U.S., said Nicole Watersheim of the nonprofit Human Rights Watch, is doing enforced disappearances. Where are the deportees being sent? About 90% have been transferred to Mexico under a Biden-era agreement that let federal agents at the southern border turn back migrants during the 2021-23 immigration surge. But Trump has tried to speed up the pace of deportations by shipping migrants to any country that will take them. In February 2025, 200 people, including 81 children, from countries including Iran, Afghanistan, Angola, and China, were flown on two planes to Costa Rica. Many of those deported had tried to claim asylum in the U.S. Weeks later, Homeland Security shipped 261 mostly Venezuelan men to the brutal CICOT prison in El Salvador. Many reported being tortured and sexually assaulted at the facility. The administration paid El Salvador more than $4 million to hold the men, whom it accused on the scant evidence of being gang members. After 4 months at CICOT, the Venezuelans were sent back to their home country. The administration then began looking farther afield for third country designations, striking deals with countries including Eswatini, Equatorial Guinea, Rwanda, and South Sudan. Is this policy legal? That's being contested in federal court. The Immigration and Nationality Act outlines a procedure for third country deportations. And in June 2025, the Supreme Court ruled the administration could deport migrants to countries other than their own without giving them a meaningful opportunity to raise fear-based claims of torture. The following month, Immigration and Customs Enforcement said officers could immediately begin sending migrants to alternative countries with as little as 6 hours' notice. Other courts, though, have rejected the agency's legal justifications for specific removals. A U.S. district judge last week ordered the Trump administration to return to the U.S. a 55-year-old Colombian asylum seeker with diabetes, hyperlipidemia, and hypothyroidism who was deported to Congo, even after the country refused to accept her because it couldn't provide sufficient medical care. The plaintiff meets the standard for irreparable harm, said Judge Richard Leon, up to and including death. What conditions do deportees face in third countries? Some have described landing in tropical locations without receiving the appropriate vaccinations and then being locked up by local authorities. Those sent to Eswatini, Africa's only absolute monarchy, were immediately ferried to a moldy, bug-infested maximum security facility where one Laotian migrant told his lawyer he felt like a caged animal. At least two of 26 migrants sent to Cameroon contracted malaria, and journalists who have tried to contact them have had their phones and laptops confiscated. In Equatorial Guinea, deportees are held under armed guard at a remote hotel. Some have contracted typhoid fever. Weeks after 11 deportees arrived in Ghana, 10 were driven to its border with Togo and told to cross over on foot. That was especially terrifying for two of the female deportees. Why was that? Because they were Togolese and had fled to the U.S. to escape the threat of genital mutilation and forced marriage. In this country, nobody can help me, said one of the women, who is now hiding in Togo. U.S. law prohibits asylum seekers from being sent to their home country if their life or freedom would be threatened. But there's no legal mechanism to stop a migrant from being deported to a third country, which then transfers them home. In November, 50 humanitarian parole recipients from Ukraine were flown to Poland and then escorted across the border to their war-torn homeland. One man on the plane was a 36-year-old who came to America as a child 20 years ago, said a deportee. He hardly speaks any Ukrainian. Are more deportations in the works? The Trump administration is drawing up plans to send 1,100 Afghan nationals currently housed at a U.S. military base in Qatar to Congo. The group includes former interpreters and special forces that fought alongside U.S. troops. Here in the U.S., more than 24,000 migrants have received third country removal orders and are awaiting deportation. It is a country I don't know. I have no family there. I don't speak their language, said Bolivian asylum seeker Jose Hugar Cruz, 37, who is set to be deported to Congo. I keep thinking it's a nightmare that I will wake up from. The art of the deportation deal. The Trump administration has been offering big benefits to developing countries willing to accept migrant deportees. A February cable sent by Secretary of State Marco Rubio advised diplomats to tell foreign government officials that a deportation deal can help a country improve its relationship with the United States. Records seen by the New York Times show that the U.S. has offered to pay foreign security forces, finance public health services, and reconsider sanctions and other punitive measures. Uganda inked a deportation deal last July. In December, the U.S. agreed to provide $1.7 billion for its health sector. Burundi recently entered a deportation agreement and soon after secured $129 million for HIV, AIDS, and malaria programs. U.S. officials deny any connection between the deportation deals and the new health spending, which partially restores funding that was cut when the administration dismantled USAID. But George Fishman, a former Trump DHS official, said the administration's message to foreign countries is clear. If you don't enter into one of these agreements, you may see things you don't like. We will pick up a few of the best columns that we didn't get to last show. First one comes from Kazakhstan. No refuge here for Russians. Russians hungry for freedom can't get a break, said Irina Garina. 3 million of them flooded into neighboring Kazakhstan in 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine, mostly men dashing for the border to avoid being sent to the front. At first, they probably thought they were returning to the good old days of Russia before sanctions. In Kazakhstan, services run smoothly. There's unblocked internet and malls featuring brands that have left Russia. Western NGOs can operate there. Universities collaborate with American and European counterparts. Sometimes human rights activists even speak out in the press. Yet Kazakhstan is changing. Constitutional reforms now give President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev even greater powers than before. And because Tokayev relies on Vladimir Putin to protect him from internal rivals, he is loath to upset the Russian president and is drifting back into Russia's orbit. The former Soviet republic has a new Russian-style ban on LGBT propaganda and a looming foreign agents law. Bloggers are rounded up under a statute similar to the Russian fake news law, and suddenly, at Moscow's request, Russians are being sent back home. Thousands who came seeking freedom and protection from war are having to pack their bags again to request asylum elsewhere. They came expecting openness, but they have found a country moving toward dictatorship. This is from France. Can film survive the far right? Not even the scariest slasher films frighten French filmmakers as much as the prospect of a President Marine Le Pen, said Giorgio Lialli. The heavyweights of the French entertainment industry at the Cannes Film Festival this week know they're doomed if the leader of the far-right national rally wins the 2027 presidential election. Le Pen was barred from running but has appealed. If she loses, her protege, Jordan Bardella, will take her place. If either got elected, they would tear up the generous system of state funding and tax breaks that helped turn France, the birthplace of cinema, into a promised land for producers of film and television. During tense 2025 budget negotiations, National Rally lawmakers actually floated dismantling the Centre National du Cinéma. They said the heavily indebted French state was squandering taxpayer money by bankrolling left-wing and woke movies that bombed at the box office, at a time when hardworking citizens have to choose between filling the gas tank or the fridge. But actors, producers, and directors know that cuts would torpedo a job-producing industry that hauls in revenue on ticket sales, attracts foreign investment, and projects French soft power at the expense of Hollywood, a blow against American hegemony. If France cedes its role as a leader in cinema now, it may never have the chance to get it back. This is from the Czech Republic. A Nazi scar that still feels sore. The return of Sudeten Germans to our soil is a bitter pill to swallow for some, said Peter Dushoslav. Hitler used these people as a pretext to dismember our country in 1938, claiming Czechoslovakia was persecuting its German minority in the north and saying he had to annex that land to protect them. After the war was over and we reclaimed the territory, some 3 million ethnic Germans were expelled, seen as traitors. But now their descendants want to have a meeting in Brno, and the Czech parliament has passed a resolution urging organizers to cancel it. Far-right Czech lawmakers consider the Munich-based group representing Sudetenland descendants to be the modern incarnation of the ethnic German party that supported Hitler. But history is not black and white. The group's leader, Bernd Posselt, has dropped his offensive rhetoric regarding the 1945-46 Venice Decree that stripped ethnic Germans of citizenship and property. And in 2015, the group abolished its explicit demand for the return of property, which was the biggest source of controversy. Sudeten Germans aren't Nazis coming to take our land. They are a displaced people who want to visit. The time has come for reconciliation. Don't forget the past, but remember to look for the future. We'll spend a little time on the health and science page today, starting with the underfunded fight against hantavirus. The recent hantavirus outbreak has put a spotlight on a rare but deadly pathogen and the lack of drugs to treat it. So far, at least three passengers from the cruise ship MV Hondius have died of the disease and eight more have been infected, a number that's likely to rise as the virus's six-week incubation period progresses. Typically carried by rats, hantavirus has a fatality rate of 38%. But doctors have few options to offer Hondius patients because there are no approved hantavirus vaccines or treatments. Scientists say some promising treatments are in development, but that a lack of funding and demand, only 10,000 hantavirus cases are reported each year, has kept those medicines from reaching the market. In a 2022 study, an antibody developed by an international team of researchers protected hamsters from the Andes strain, which is behind the current outbreak and able to spread between humans. In a small 2024 trial, a DNA vaccine developed by the Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases resulted in more than 80% of participants producing neutralizing antibodies for the Andes strain. And Moderna, which developed one of the main COVID shots, has conducted some early research on hantavirus vaccine. Such treatments could be fast-tracked, but only with a substantial funding boost. That's where people like us always get stuck, immunologist Tony Schultz tells Scientific American. We have the lead candidates, but we don't have the $25 million to $50 million to go the next step. A volcano scrubs the atmosphere. It's long been known that volcanic eruptions can fuel climate change, but a recent blast might also offer a clue on how to fight it. When Hunga Tonga Hunga Hapai, an undersea volcano in the South Pacific, blew its top in 2022, it shot some 360 kilotons of planet-warming methane into the atmosphere. But a new study suggests the blast also sparked a chemical reaction that erased 990 tons of the greenhouse gas every day for more than a week. In the stratosphere, saltwater blown upward by the volcano interacted with ash and sunlight to create highly reactive chlorine, which broke down the methane. That process could be seen in satellite images of the volcanic plume, which showed unusually high concentrations of formaldehyde, which forms briefly when methane is destroyed. The study suggests chlorine could be used to scrub atmospheric methane, which has about 80 times the warming power of carbon dioxide. Scientists could try to replicate this natural phenomenon, study co-author Matthew Johnson of the University of Copenhagen tells Popular Mechanics, but only if it can be proven safe and effective. Unconscious, but still learning. The human brain can process language even when it's under anesthesia, reports Time. That's the finding of a study that examined seven people undergoing brain surgery for epilepsy. The researchers first looked at how the anesthetized patients reacted when they were played repeating tones, occasionally interrupted by a different sound. Neurons in the hippocampus, which helps process and organize incoming information, responded to those odd sounds. And the response grew as time passed. suggesting some kind of learning process was taking place. Researchers then played a podcast and observed the neurons react differently to nouns, verbs, and adjectives in the way the team would have expected from people who were awake. The study gives you a new perspective on how much the brain can process when no conscious awareness is involved, said neuroscientist Leon Duell, who wasn't involved in the study. This doesn't mean anesthetized patients can understand what surgeons are saying in the operating room, Duell notes, but rather suggests that complex processes involving language may happen unconsciously. Secrets of the Singing Mice. In the cloud forests of Central America, the high-pitched chirps of Alston's singing mice can often be heard among the trees. The teensy short-tailed mice sing unique songs to one another that can last up to 16 seconds and never interrupt their musical partners. Scientists have for years wondered how the tiny rodents can sustain such complex conversations without a big brain. A mystery that researchers at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory may now have solved. By comparing the brains of Alston's singing mice with those of their less tuneful lab mice cousins, they were able to track the evolutionary changes that gave rise to their vocal talents. They discovered only one small difference. The singing mice had approximately three times the number of neurons sending signals from the motor cortex to two specific downstream regions of the brain. That same mutation is thought to have enabled the development of human speech. When even a tiny change in the brain can have such a profound effect, study co-author Akarup Banjari tells the New York Times, suddenly, the development of things like language in humans doesn't seem that mysterious. And we'll pick up a little bit of the business news at a glance. Stocks, Trump's astonishing trading spree. President Trump's latest financial disclosures showed that he or his investment advisors made more than 3,700 trades in the first quarter, totaling tens of millions of dollars, said Bill Allison and Jess Minton in Bloomberg. The transactions, spelled out in more than 100 pages of documents filed last week with the U.S. Office of Government Ethics, includes $1 million each in companies including NVIDIA, Oracle, Microsoft, Boeing, and Costco, raising conflict of interest concerns. The volume of trading, more than 40 per day over a three-month period, is the kind of activity usually done by a hedge fund, not a personal account. It's an insane amount of trades, said investor Matthew Tuttle. This is the E-Trade presidency, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It's massively corrupt and arguably illegal, and if not, it should be, for Trump to be buying and selling shares of companies like Amazon, Apple, and others with contracting or regulatory issues in Washington. Nothing should be more fundamental to Democrats than promising to voters that if they retake the House in the fall, they will hold corruption hearings that provide a venue for what would amount to national truth and reconciliation hearings. Democrats can't sit idly as the president is fiddling with day trades while America burns. Honda, carmaker reports first loss in 70 years. Japanese automaker Honda last week posted its first annual loss since 1957 after demand for its electric vehicles plummeted, said River Akira Davis in the New York Times. The company reported a net loss of $2.7 billion during the 2025 fiscal year, dragged down by a $9 billion hit in restructuring charges and write-downs for pulling back on its struggling EV transition. 5 years ago, Honda pledged to make its entire lineup electric or hydrogen-powered by 2040. It has since nixed that goal and canceled three upcoming electric models. Prediction markets. Feds sue after Minnesota ban. Minnesota this week banned prediction market sites from operating in the state and was almost immediately sued by the federal government, said Bobby Allen in NPR.org. Governor Tim Walz signed the nation's first law making it a crime to host or advertise any prediction markets in the state, which will force firms like Kalshi and Polymarket to cease operations there in August. But the Commodity Futures Trading Commission wants to block the law before it starts, arguing that it has exclusive jurisdiction over prediction markets. Nevada is the only state to have secured a court-enforced ban on Kalshi. Shine. Chinese fast fashion giant buys Everlane. Fans of the sustainable fashion brand Everlane said they felt betrayed after the company sold itself to a Chinese fast fashion giant this week, said Danya Isawi in nymag.com. The San Francisco-based retailer, which primarily sold products directly to consumers online, held itself up as a bastion of eco-friendliness, disclosing its supply chain and opting for natural fibers for much of its offerings. But customers are wondering if it can abide by such goals after a $100 million sale to Shine, which has been accused of shoddy labor practices at its factories. And the last word, our feature article, the doomed dive to the Titanic. In June 2023, Christine Dawood watched her husband and son climb aboard a submersible to view the wreck of the ocean liner, said Pamela Gordon in The Guardian. They would never return. Walking into Christine Dawood's kitchen, it's impossible not to be drawn to the model Titanic in the center of the room. Sitting in its own glass-fronted cabinet, the Lego ship is almost 5 feet long, constructed of 9,090 of the iconic plastic bricks. Dawood's 19-year-old son Suleiman, spent almost 2 weeks building it. "People are always a bit shocked to see it," she admits. "But what was I going to do? Break it up? Hide it away?" Suleiman put all those hours in. On June 18, 2023, Suleiman Dawood died alongside his 48-year-old father, Shahzada, and three other men in the Titan submersible as it attempted to dive to the Titanic. They were 1,640 feet above the wreck when the submersible imploded. It was a horrifying tragedy that made headlines around the world. "The Titanic was claiming another five people, right?" Dawood says. "In the age of my son was a huge thing. Another reason the press latched onto this, I think." We're in the family home in southeast England where she lives with her 20-year-old daughter. Floor-to-ceiling windows take up an entire side of the room. "She needs that sense of light and space," Dawood tells me, after growing up in the mountains of Bavaria. On the walls hang richly colored Pakistani art, mostly gifts from her in-laws, to whom she remains extremely close. "I love this house still," she tells me, "even though they are not here anymore." A media frenzy broke out with the news that the Titan was missing. Was the sub trapped in the wreck itself, or floating adrift in the North Atlantic? Reports circulated that the stricken craft had just 4 days of oxygen. As details emerged about the men on board, word spread that Dawood should have been on the submersible herself, but had given the ticket to her son. Almost 3 years on, she holds close the advice she was given when she came ashore after the four-day search. One of the Canadian Coast Guards, she remembers, gave me the best advice I've ever gotten. Hindsight won't help you, so don't fall into that trap. Just because you know it now, you didn't know it before. I've always remembered her telling me that. Suleiman wanted to go, and I was happy to give up the seat. I was happy for him to make memories with his father. I can't change that. During the 2020 COVID lockdown, Dawood had been scrolling through Instagram when an advertisement for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to dive to the Titanic popped up. I couldn't believe it, and I called the travel agency. Quintessentially, she recalls, the dive was being promoted by OceanGate, a company founded in 2009 by Stockton Rush with the aim of democratizing the deep ocean. Quintessentially agreed to look into it, but it would be another 2 years before they called to ask if the DeWoods were still interested. It was a shitload of money, she recalls, $500,000 for two seats. She laughs slightly, shaking her head at the cost now. But the family could afford it. Shahzada was from one of Pakistan's wealthiest families, and they began planning to join OceanGate's 2023 expedition. Whatever due diligence I did, she tells me, I didn't find a single civilian submersible accident. That was good enough for me. During a meeting in London in February 2023, Rush set about reassuring the Dawoods that the trip would be worth every cent. He boasted about how unique the Titan was, with its carbon fiber hull and cylindrical shape. Most submersibles are made of titanium or high-strength steel and are spherical. No other submersible could take as many as five people to the deep ocean, he told me. He'd already made dreams come true by taking it to the Titanic 13 times. He described the strange ocean creatures and flashes of blue, green, and eerie white bioluminescence they would see floating past the large viewing port, the largest on planet Earth, as he liked to call it, and finally, how they would arrive at the wreck itself. They'd glide toward the iconic bow encrusted with rusticles, the microorganisms slowly eating through the great ship's skeleton. But there was a lot Rush didn't mention, things Dawood would only find out after the tragedy. He failed to tell them about how many aborted dives and hundreds of technical issues that had plagued the Titan during its two short seasons in the North Atlantic, or that in July 2022, while ascending, passengers had heard an explosive noise that shook the submersible, which Rush had never investigated, or that the sub was operating under the radar, that he had refused to have it inspected or classified by any maritime authority, claiming that the safety process was too slow and stifled innovation. Nor did Rush mention that for the past 6 months, the Titan had been sitting in a parking lot in St. John's, uncovered and unwatched, exposed to the icy conditions of the Newfoundland winter. On June 14th, the family set off with a mixture of nervous excitement. 2 days later, they arrived in St. John's and jumped aboard the Polar Prince, a ship that would take them 400 miles southeast across the North Atlantic to Titanic waters. Unbeknown to Dawood, funds were running low and the Polar Prince was all Rush could afford. An old icebreaker, the ship was not originally designed to carry passengers, and its spoon-shaped hull pitched and rolled continually. In 2021 and 2022, OceanGate had hired a modern ship, the Horizon Arctic, which had transported the Titan on deck. And it was impossible to carry the sub on board the Polar Prince. It was towed behind on a platform, buffeted and pounded by the waves. This was the roughest we'd ever traveled, DeWood said. I'm almost 50 and you put me in a bunk bed with scratchy bedsheets. Cruise ships have very nice stabilizers, and you pay $500,000 for this? But she laughs and tells me how they joked about it. After 2 days at sea, the Polar Prince arrived in Titanic waters. Shahzada and Suleiman were given jumpsuits, the kind you see astronauts in, bearing their names and the Ocean Gate logo. They were joined by Rush, who was piloting, a British businessman named Hamish Harding, and French diver Paul-Henri Nargileau, dubbed Mr. Titanic, as the world's leading authority on the wreck. He had already seen the ship 37 times, 5 times on board the Titan, and acted as the expert guide for Ocean Gate. Dawood watched as her husband and son were transported to the Titan, floating about 330 feet away from its launch and recovery platform. Once the men had been guided into the sub, the hatch was bolted shut, and the flotation tanks at each corner of the platform were flooded with water. The Titan sank beneath the waves, detached from its platform, and started its free fall. It would take about 3 hours to reach the wreck, 2.5 miles down on the ocean floor. At around 11 a.m., Dawood was in the dining area, longing for a seasickness cure, when the first blow landed. "They've lost communications," she heard someone say. Then they noticed her. "Don't worry, it's not unusual," she was told. "In that moment, what am I supposed to do?" she says now. "I felt trapped on that ship, and I had no choice but to trust what they told me." The Ocean Gate crew seemed unfazed. They had been through this before, and all would be well. The sub would still return by 3 p.m. At 6:30 p.m., there was still no sign of the Titan. Kyle Bingham, Ocean Gate's mission director, called a briefing and declared that the Titan was now officially missing. "I told myself they were stuck," Dawood recalls, "but I was worried. Suleiman is not, well, both my men, they're not very good at being in the dark, and I knew it would be very different darkness down there." The doctor, she recalls, gave her something for seasickness and asked another tourist who had been hoping to be on the next dive to keep an eye on her. She remembers wandering around the ship, desperate for news, but scared of what she might overhear. As the search and rescue operation kicked into gear, the skies above the Polar Prince were split by the trails of planes sent by the U.S. and Canadian Coast Guards. Back in St. John's, the media gathered at the harbor, press conferences were held, theories discussed, and rumors spread about a toxic culture at Ocean Gate. But 400 miles out to sea, Dawood was solely dependent on the company briefings. "I deleted all news from my phone. I wasn't even really aware of the oxygen countdown. All I'd been told by the crew was that they could last 4 days down there, no more." The energy on the ship was complete denial, she says. Bingham continued to predict there had been a technical issue and talked about banging that he had heard. "Regular and significant," he reassured everyone. "They were trying to locate where it was coming from. It's just taking time," he told them. On June 22nd, the Horizon Arctic arrived at the scene carrying a remotely operated vehicle capable of diving to the Titanic depth. It was deployed and reached the bottom in 90 minutes. Casting its robotic gaze across the seabed, it sent footage to the operators above and to the U.S. Coast Guard, which was now in command. They spotted something at the edge of the frame, the twisted remnants of the Titan's tail cone. Every indication at this point is that a catastrophic event has occurred with the Titan, were the carefully chosen words of the U.S. Coast Guard officer. The Titan's hull had failed almost 3 hours into the dive. Under the immense pressures of the deep ocean, it had imploded, collapsing inward in a fraction of a second. The five men died instantaneously. "My first thought was thank God," admits Dawood. "When they said catastrophic, I knew Shahzada and Suleiman didn't even know about it. One moment they were there, and the next they weren't. Knowing they didn't suffer has been so important." And that is when Dawood found herself in what she calls the after. The dregs of hope she had clung to in the middle of the ocean were gone, and she had to face the practical business of getting home. What was I going to do with their stuff? their bags. Shahzada's clothes and things were in my cabin, so I packed his bags. But I didn't pack Suleiman's. I couldn't. Someone else did that. Shahzada's family had flown from Pakistan to take her back to London. She carried Suleiman's backpack onto the plane and remembers how important that became to her mother-in-law. She just wanted to hug the backpack. She held on to it all the way and kept apologizing, saying, "I could take the bag back." But I said, "No, you can keep it. You lost them too." Over the next 18 months, the U.S. Coast Guard carried out an investigation into Stockton Rush and Ocean Gate. The fatal flaws that had been lying in wait came to light, along with the many warnings Rush had ignored. The official report concluded that the tragedy was preventable and caused by inadequate engineering and testing, as well as Rush's reckless approach. If he had survived, he would have faced criminal proceedings. From the beginning, I had a lot of reasons to hate Stockton, but does that really help me? Dawood said. He died with them. If I'm angry with him, I'm giving him power, and I refuse to do that. She pauses, then continues in a whisper. It's very hard. Being strong doesn't mean you're not feeling it. After a while, Dawood takes me out into the garden. It's the first day the sun has made an appearance after weeks of rain, and the cat has found its way into a fragile square of sunlight on one of the raised beds. It's the normal questions that people ask that are still the most difficult, she says, like, "Do you have children?" That is the most dreaded question. I knew it would come, but it constantly takes me off guard. I just say I have a daughter. I'm not lying, but it's what I choose to say. We sit very quietly for a minute or two. It's not easy finding the way to end the time we've spent discussing this unimaginable grief. But then Dawood turns her attention to the garden. "I'm waiting for the tulips now," she said. "I have hundreds of them, and more come up every spring." As I look closely, I notice the many clumps of wide green leaves hiding the beginnings of the flowers to come. A longer version of this article appeared in The Guardian. We'll read one of the obituaries for you. The NBA player who had the courage to come out, Jason Collins, 1978 to 2026. Jason Collins didn't set out to make history, though he joined the NBA in 2001 and played for six teams in 13 seasons. His biggest impact on professional sports came late in his career, when he became the first player in any of the four major men's pro sports to come out as gay while still competing. In a 2013 Sports Illustrated cover story he wrote himself, Collins said he couldn't believe that at this late date, somebody still had to be the trailblazer. "If I had my way, someone else would have already done this," he said. "Nobody has, which is why I'm raising my hand." The Sports Illustrated essay transformed Collins from a largely anonymous role player into a historic figure, said the Washington Post. The announcement gave new meaning to a quiet gesture he had made for years, wearing jersey number 98 in honor of Matthew Shepard, the gay college student murdered in 1998 in a Wyoming hate crime. The Los Angeles-born Collins received supportive phone calls from Oprah Winfrey and President Obama. And NBA Commissioner David Stern praised his leadership. Still, Collins was a free agent when the story was published, and some speculated it would end his basketball career. Instead, he signed a midseason contract with the Brooklyn Nets, his original team. After retiring in 2014, Collins forged a second career as a public speaker and political activist, said the New York Times. He campaigned for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and spoke annually with basketball rookies as an ambassador for the NBA Cares initiative. Collins disclosed last December that he had been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. "Still, I got to tell my story," he said. "And now I can honestly say the past 12 years since have been the best of my life." A couple of short pieces from the technology page. Data center drains Georgia's water. The neighbors of a massive data center in Georgia are up in arms after discovering the facility guzzled nearly 30 million gallons of water without paying for it, said Ariana Scabell in Politico. Outrage started bubbling up last year when residents of an affluent subdivision in Fayetteville, Georgia, noticed their water pressure was unusually low. When the county utility investigated, they discovered two industrial-scale water hookups feeding a 615-acre data center being built in town. The Blackstone-based developer, Quality Technology Services, owed nearly $150,000 for using enough water to fill 44 Olympic-sized swimming pools, far exceeding the peak limit agreed to during the data center planning process. News of the incident comes as Georgia is in the midst of the highest levels of drought and battling wildfire outbreaks. AI upends Princeton's honor code. Princeton is changing its honor code for the first time in 133 years because AI has made it so easy to cheat, said Douglas Belkin in the Wall Street Journal. Faculty at the prestigious Ivy League University voted last week to require proctoring in all in-person exams starting this summer, reversing a policy set in place in 1893 that let students take exams without a professor present. Those days are over, largely because of artificial intelligence tools that have all the answers. If the exam is on a laptop, someone can just flip to another window, one Princeton senior said. Or if the exam is in a blue book, it's just people using their phone under the desk or going to the bathroom and using it. The Princeton student newspaper last year found that 30% of surveyed students cheated on an assignment or an exam. And we're on the Talking Points page. A couple of articles here. Cuba, Trump's next takeover target. American pressure campaigns against Cuba are nothing new, said Jim Weiss in Bloomberg. But perhaps no president has turned the screws quite like President Trump. 4 months after the U.S. imposed a de facto energy blockade by severing the communist regime's oil lifeline from Venezuela, the country is nearing complete collapse. The economy is in freefall. The island suffers nearly round-the-clock rolling blackouts, and the government last week announced diesel and fuel oil had run out. CIA Director John Ratcliffe visited Havana last week for high-level talks, and the State Department is offering $100 million in aid in exchange for meaningful reforms that include new people in charge. The administration is ramping up its regime change ambitions, said Alexandra Sharp in Foreign Policy. Federal prosecutors are seeking to indict former Cuban President Raul Castro for his role in the 1996 downing of two U.S. humanitarian planes, similar to how it indicted Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro before invading. As his administration tightens the noose, Trump says Cuba will be falling pretty soon. The ongoing war in Iran is a complicating factor for Trump, said Shelby Talcott and Nicholas Wu in Semaphore. His inability to topple or subjugate the Iranian regime has inflicted a political toll that will affect his decision on whether to use force. Cuba is just 90 miles from Key West, Florida, and a U.S. invasion that includes bombing and firefights could cause a humanitarian crisis that results in thousands of refugees landing on American soil. Nonetheless, the Pentagon has been gaming out scenarios for direct military action, said Nahal Toos in Politico. The options range from a single airstrike meant to scare the regime into concessions to an outright ground invasion meant to uproot it. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, has recently played up the idea that Cuba poses a national security threat. Spooked officials in Havana have reportedly amassed some 300 drones and are discussing how to inflict maximum damage, including an attack on Key West. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel warned that a U.S. attack would provoke a bloodbath of incalculable consequences. But even the U.S.'s struggles in Iran might not be a deterrent, as it may make Trump seek another easy victory, like the invasion in Venezuela. Like it or not, Trump might really attack Cuba. Israel. Did prison guards rape Palestinians? The New York Times has accused Israeli prison guards and soldiers of systematic sexual abuse of Palestinians, said Rachel O'Donohue in National Review. But its shocking allegations aren't credible. In a report last week, Times columnist Nicholas Kristof purported to document widespread rape of Palestinian prisoners by Israeli jailers, which he claims is condoned by the Israeli government. He describes men raped with batons and carrots and the sexual abuse of children, and adds a grotesque flourish, the rape of prisoners by dogs trained for that purpose. This shoddy report relies on dubious sourcing. Most of the 14 victims cited aren't named. The two he does name have changed the stories they've told. Kristof repeatedly cites claims by a Geneva-based human rights group with ties to Hamas and a history of promoting inflammatory and unfounded allegations against Israel. Given how canine biology works, the dog rape claim doesn't pass the most basic smell test, said Douglas Murray in the New York Post. So why would the Times print it, except to portray Israelis as absolute monsters? This backlash to the ugly truth is utterly predictable, said Yuli Novak in The Guardian. Pro-Israel voices assailed the Times, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to sue over the blood libel. But Kristof's report is hardly unique. The torture and rape of Palestinians has long been reported by dozens of former detainees and documented by my own Israeli human rights group. As with its brutal policies in Gaza and the West Bank, Israel's detention system is built on the denial of Palestinian humanity. In assessing the credibility of Kristof's report, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter, it's important to remember the horrors Americans inflicted at Abu Ghraib, including using dogs to sexually humiliate naked Iraqis. When enemies come to see each other as subhuman, the darkness is deep. After Hamas' October 7, 2023 massacre of Israelis, it was the Palestinians and their defenders who adamantly denied horrific reports of rape and sexual torture, said Emily Tankin in The Forward. A new investigation has documented that Hamas' sexual assault of Israelis was widespread. Why do we automatically believe that, yes, this side carries out sexual violence, but no, that side doesn't? When you dismiss any allegations that go against the side you root for, you're not just denying the alleged victims their humanity, you risk robbing yourself of your own humanity, too. And a few of the shorter notes. Ukraine won back more of its land than Russia seized in April, the first territorial shift in Kyiv's favor since August 2024. Up to 352,000 Russians are estimated to have been killed so far in the four-year war. Ukraine has suffered an estimated 100,000 to 150,000 casualties. The U.S. response to the hantavirus outbreak is being partly led by Admiral Brian Christine, an Alabama urologist who specializes in penile implants and who claimed in 2022 that the Biden administration used the COVID pandemic to control people and to influence the outcome of the 2020 elections. More than 100,000 children have been separated from their parents during the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Roughly three-quarters of those children are U.S. citizens. Jewish lawmakers are reporting a surge in anti-Semitic calls and emails to their offices and a spike in in-person harassment. Hitler was spot on, wrote one constituent to Representative Jerry Nadler, Democrat from New York. You guys are going to be shot dead every effing day, was left on the voicemail of Representative Max Miller, Republican from Ohio. It's no longer a Republican and Democrat issue, said Miller. Both ends of our parties are wackadoos who hate Jews. Of the 195 U.S. ambassador posts, 115 remain vacant 18 months into the second Trump administration. The country lacks ambassadors in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Ukraine, Russia, and 37 of the 51 U.S. embassies in Africa. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Reinhold Niebuhr. He says, "Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. I'm Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.